another podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.
From the intersection of technology and public accounting,
it's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession. Tech2Go is sponsored by ADP.
Good afternoon. Greg LaFollette, the CPA Technology Advisor. Intersection Live, our podcast series, monthly recurring podcast. Today, recording episode 14 of the granddaddy of our podcast series, Tech2Go. And today I have our regular panelist with us, Randy Johnston of wide fame in our profession. And Randy, I know we chatted a little bit. You're home. That's unusual. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you here. And our friend out in the Pacific Northwest, a longtime columnist for the CPA Technology Advisor, a man who has more initials behind his name than in front, also a real-life practicing accountant, former president of the Oregon Society, and Microsoft fanboy, Brent Goodfellow. Good afternoon, Brent.
Well, let's not go that far.
Okay. I thought maybe I could get away with it if I said some nice things that I could jump in there.
Wanted to know if I was listening, didn't you?
Exactly. Well, I caught you paying attention. So, and our guest today, a special guest, I'm very, very excited to introduce my friend Jim Metzler. Jim is the Vice President of Small Firm Interests with the AICPA, a position he's had for 5 years and probably about 500,000 miles plus, I'm sure. Jim, longtime practitioner from Buffalo, a lot of things in the technology world, and then one day got a call from the AICPA who said, you know, Jim, we'd really like to do some special things with small firms, and we think you're the guy to do it. And Jim, what did you say to that call?
I'll be there.
All right. Welcome,
no problem,
Jim, and I very much appreciate your time. I know you're a busy guy this time of the year, and so I appreciate your taking the time and sharing your expertise with the now well over 1,000 people practitioners who listen to us every month, or at least they download us and make us feel good, guys. I'm not sure that they all listen, but sometimes it seems like it. You know, we've been out and visiting with people and out at trade shows and things, and people come up and comment and say they've listened to Tech2Go, and that's kind of fun. Randy thinks I pay guys to say that to us, but it's fun when they do come up.
And if you are, just keep paying them, okay?
Exactly, it's fun. Just a couple of notes for those of you who may be new to Tech2Go. As we mentioned, products or websites or anything like that, we try to keep fairly good show notes. So no need to run off for a pencil or try and scribble down notes as one of us talks about something. Just go to the CPA Technology Advisor website. That's cpatechadvisor.com or cpata.com, which is what I use. And follow the couple of links there to Intersection Live and this particular show, Tech2Go Episode 14, and you'll find there a list of all of those different things that we talked about. And we hyperlink them and everything, so it makes it nice and easy for you. We do record live. We're recording live on TalkShoe.com right now, and I don't see any guests with us, but occasionally we do, and we invite them to come and listen. And if you raise your hand electronically, we might even pull you in and visit with you and answer your questions. We're always willing to do that. We are doing our next recording on March 13th. At 3 p.m. Eastern, And we'd welcome you to episode 15. And then the following week, on the 20th, we're recording episode 16. We're going to do two episodes in March because I'm going to be out of the country for the month of April. I'll be in Brazil with a Rotary group, so I'm unable to record. It's actually not true. As Brent pointed out, it's not unable, it's unwilling, Brent, to take the time to do that. So I appreciate you guys scheduling in those two recordings, and if any of our listeners want to join us, we're always interested in having that. Finally, we do maintain a voicemail box if you want to call in and leave comments or thoughts or questions. Feel free to do so. That's 800-456-0864, extension 2106. So if you have some sort of question or comment or you want to interact with us, that's certainly a way to do it. Email also works. So guys, we have a real busy schedule today. A lot of things we'd like to talk about, and I kind of wanted to start by I got a couple of emails from practitioners asking me what I knew about what the vendors were going to do, the tax compliance guys, what they were going to do with the new rebate rules and how they were going to incorporate that. Any of you guys heard anything or any comments? I've tried to reach out to the vendors, and I'll share that later. But Brent, you're in the middle of a firm out there. What are the practitioners saying?
Well, we use both the CCH product and the Thompson product, and we have not heard anything from either of those companies officially on how they're going to handle it. So I just don't know.
Right. Well, I've got I have communicated with Intuit on their two products. That would be Lacerte and ProSeries. Don't know anything or care anything about TurboTax. CCH with there are actually three products with ProFX and ATX and TaxWise. Thompson with GoSystem Tax RS and with UltraTax, and also the guys over at Drake. Pretty much TaxWorks also. So as I talked to all of them, none of them seem to have a product out there or an update out there. But all of them say that very, very quickly they're going to do something to calculate that ESA rebate amount. And I haven't seen that happen yet, but I do understand that there is or was scheduled for yet this week a software industry call with the IRS for the IRS to figure out or tell the industry or figure out what the industry needed for people who, for what would be non-filers, but who want to file and make sure that they're on the list for the rebate. There's as usual, Congress does this thing at the last moment, and then the profession has to clean up after them. Big problem. Randy, you're in a lot. You've worked a lot, I know, with the IRS and some of their special forums and groups that they have with the practitioners. Will they be able to pull this off, so our practitioners will be able to help their clients?
I think it will get pulled off. I don't think it's a particularly complex piece that has to be added. But it's obviously highly disruptive with most of the software development tests completed well before the start of the year. Traditionally what happens is most of the tax companies have their products pretty much in line by the fourth quarter and ready to go, just waiting any final legislative changes. But since this one is relatively simple, I think they'll get it done.
Yeah, it certainly would be nice, as you get ready to send your returns out the door, it would be nice to be able to tell your client this is the rebate that you can expect to get. Because at the point that you're signing the return, you have all the information, I think. Jim, have you looked at it?
I have not spent much time with it. No.
Okay. Okay. But, I mean, as a practitioner back from the olden days, would you concur that you'd like to be able to answer what's really pretty much a simple question?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But it certainly would be nice to have that done automatically for you.
Yep.
Okay. Well, all of the vendors indicate that they're going to be doing something. Yes, we will be doing something to calculate the ESA rebate amount, you know, optimize for married filing joint, married filing single, on the return, because that's part of it too. You know, it's no longer, you know, you have to calculate this rebate and the effect of that before you file the return. So this is kind of a stopper for people who practice in a certain area. Now for higher end firms where you're, you know, most of your client base is well above the maximums, I guess it doesn't matter how you got above there. You're just above.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to, you know, that's just the whole question of that. If you guys are listening and you do get a solution, do me a favor and send me a quick note so I know where we're at. It's kind of tough to keep track of, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 different software packages and, you know, see who's doing what. And I would like to keep up with it, and then I'll add those updates to the techgap.com, my blog, as they happen, so you'll at least know whether you're keeping up with the Joneses. So I want to move on and get over to the part that's really fun. I want to talk with you, Jim Metzler, about some of the things that you're doing over at the Institute. First, do me a favor and kind of lay out how did that conversation go with Barry when he called you? What was the vision originally, and how has that changed, or is it still exactly the same?
Okay, that's the story I enjoy telling. I don't get a chance to say it very often, but I had actually been, at the time, I left my firm to coach firms full-time and with Jennifer Wilson Convergence Coaching. And, of course, Yelena is an active volunteer like you are, Greg, and others on the phone. And I was approached by the Institute probably a year prior to, actually taking an employment position, to consult with them to develop the job description. And so I consulted, I developed a job description, and as I was doing it, I became more and more lit up by, you know, what it was all about and excited, you know, having lived in a small firm for 32 years. Time went on, and they said, well, Jim, would you like to be this person and do it on a consulting basis? I know you've been self-employed your entire working life, just about, some 35 years. And I said, sure, you have a tremendous opportunity, but they needed to take it to the board. And the board said, what we want is, it'd be great to have Jim do this for us and be in this position, but we need a full-time, 100% dedicated AI CPA employee. Small firms are critically important to us. And time went on, and they kept trying different iterations. And one day I said to Barry and Al Anderson at the time, I said, well, what would employment look like? I haven't been employed by anybody for, 35 years. And they went on to describe it, and, it sounded pretty good. The only issues were, could I continue to live in Buffalo where my family and grandchildren are? And absolutely, that was not an issue. I really don't live in Buffalo anymore. I live in airport to airport, like Randy and you do, Greg. However, the work continues to light me up to really get to those firms that I grew up in, that be a voice for them at the many tables of not just inside the Institute, but in the regulatory and legislative areas. And it's been that and more of everything that when we wrote the job description and developed it. I can tell you that after 5 years, looking back, every bit of sincerity, and I'm just telling you, you know me for a long time, Greg, I'll always be straight with you, in all sincerity, that the Institute's heart has been and continues to be in the right place for small firms. We get a lot about, you're run by the big firms. That is not at all accurate. But the seriousness and the actions that come by taking that voice to all these many tables across the Institute, whether it be accounting principles, whether it be auditing standards, whether it be personal financial planning, whether it be standards issues, the voice of the small firm is respected and action happens. If it just became kind of a position, a figurehead type position or whatever, I wouldn't have stayed more than a few months. And it's been far, 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 far the other side of that description. So it's been very cool. And I'm honored after all these years of working with clients and kitchen tables and dining room tables to now be at the tables of FASB, the government, all the various areas of the United States small business economy, including the SBA that we just entered into an alliance with. Very
well, good. Jim, you've taken a bunch of parts of the Institute and kind of put them together. My firm joined PCPS about 1,000 years ago, the day they formed the thing, and, have been members since then. I've always been a big fan. It's had its strong points and its not so strong points, and I think right now it's at a strong point under your leadership. You've pulled that back together in kind of an organization along with all of the specialized credentials. Talk a little bit about why you see the PCPS and all of the credentials all in one pot.
Okay. That is driven by, again, that all those experiences as a small firm practitioner in dealing with small business, private company, family businesses, startup businesses, multi-generation businesses, and the like. And the notion is this, that, through many areas of the AICPA, everything is an audit, is an audit, is an audit, is an audit. And we all know that in the world of small business, everything is certainly not is an audit, is an audit, is an audit. An audit is critically important. Compilation reviews for sure, tax returns absolutely for sure, but y'all know, folks on the phone know, and those listening to this podcast know, that the relationship of the CPA, small firm, medium firm CPA, is driven by the trusted advisor relationship. It's just not that work that creates that relationship or that strong bond for many years. If you look at our PCPS map survey, you'll find that 2/3 of any client relationship of the PCPS type firms is the core accounting and tax. But 33%, a little better than 33% of that relationship is a mix of I guess you'd call it advisory, trusted advisor, but the consultative CPA to client relationships, they're driven by have a component of personal financial planning. Personal financial planning side being how are we going to afford college for the kids, how are we going to fund the illiquidity in our estate, how do we transfer wealth, how do we transfer the business, very, very highly tied to tax and a number of other issues. We can help as small firm practitioners get into those very, very important high-value discussions with clients. IT, the exact, soft spot for me, again, you can't help but get into those IT relationships with clients as their systems come apart, as they don't reconcile. Just look at the QuickBooks, Peachtree, small business accounting environment in the compelling nature of IT and some of the basic issues on security and privacy. Practitioners can't help but have that kind of attribute to their practice. We have business valuation. We're all involved, the CPAs, with buy-sell agreements between family members, between business owners, valuation issues that may be a result of a disagreement, a divorce, an estate. Again, we can't help but get in business valuation type situations, even if it's a merger or an acquisition of another small business. Forensic and litigation support, again, the whole notion of that client relationship may be lost income reconstruction, court cases and the like. So what I wanted to do is meld those disciplines together with disciplines in PCPS that were all about how do you build a niche practice, how do you build that specialty practice, how do you bring more value to clients. It's a combination of all those areas that kind of personify that client relationship. So bringing all those groups together into one place helps us put together a support structure for firms that would almost look like a large firms type national office that would enable a place for a member to come and access specialty areas as well as figure out, that's the technical side, say personal financial planning, but how to build a niche practice in these areas if they want to go to the next step. If they want to become the super experts, they can get a credential. We're leveraging our intellectual property. We're finding that many of the lessons in practice management, lessons and principles, all those section areas. So that's kind of that was the theory behind it. We also Carolina, which gave us a tremendous opportunity for combining teams and consolidating redundant processes, and that was very, very common. So, like, long story short, we've created almost a firm section and a firm section machine, kind of a firm client relationship machine in one group.
So, Jim, you go out and make a lot of calls. I know you spend a lot of time in airplanes, and you walk into accounting firms all across America. So, walk into that firm out there in Beaverton where Brent is, and Brent, why don't you and Jim have this conversation? What's on your mind as a practice unit out there that the AICPA should be doing or Mr. Metzler here should be paying attention to? What do you think?
Well, I think over the years AICPA has done a lot for small firms. I'm not sure they've done a great job of telling the small firms what they've done for them. And the reason I say that is I constantly hear practitioners saying things like, well, the only benefit that I have from my AICPA membership is cheap insurance. You know, and you hear that all the time. And yet for someone like myself who has served, you know, as a key contact person for legislative issues and been involved otherwise, then you see that there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that's going on. And the non-educated member of the firm is looking at their copy of the Journal of Accountancy and their insurance billing, perhaps, and the rest of it is really just an annoyance and a dues statement once a year. And it seems to me like I would be a proponent of encouraging the AICPA to educate members of small firms to a greater degree on exactly what those dues are paying for and the real benefits that are coming out of them.
Yeah, that's Brent. That's great advice, and I would totally agree that we have not done a great job telling our members what we have done for them. You know, and all that happens behind the scenes. You know, we've stepped up. Getting that right mode of communication is always a challenge a bit. I think things such as podcasts, what you're doing here, Greg, I think is something we could emulate greatly. But there are 33,000, Brent, you make a great point, there are 33,000 sole owner firms, single, very, very small firms. We're doing a lot to better target that group with, Small Firm Solutions and some of the newsletters. But I would agree, the things that happen behind the scenes, I was close to the Institute as a volunteer for many, many, many years, and once I got on the inside, I was just kind of blown away the number of things that I, as a practitioner, really never appreciated quite as much. Many of the things that happen, with the regulators and legislators, it's almost our job to make sure that you don't hear about them to a certain extent. You know, there are some things that, you want to get done kind of quietly that have to do with some state regulations and things, but we could do a whole lot better job just hitting the right things to the right members and targeting the communication to the size. Good advice. And
well, we are Jim, Tech2Go, and we're part of the CPA Technology Advisor. So I want to pull this back over into the technology world a little bit, and,
yep.
And I'm going to ask my friend Randy Johnson, probably speaks with more of your AICPA members around the country, specifically about technology, than any of us do. Randy, how do you see what the Institute is doing over in the technology world? What could we do better? What do people say when you're out?
Well, actually, as Jim Brennan has been going back and forth here, that is actually, unfortunately, pretty accurate. So many of the shareholders, partners, and so forth that I bump into really don't see a lot of proactive recommendations coming down from the Institute. I think they trust and would look to advise from there. I think Jim, without tipping any cards here, and you should tip the ones that you want to tip, I think there are initiatives that the AICPA has planned, and some of those things can be very helpful to the practitioners. And I think there is also a desire from a lot of the firms to be looking for, let's call it best practices and guidance. In other words, the right way to do some of these things. You know, I think they're concerned about, the firms are concerned about quality of practice for their clients, and they would follow what they would consider guidelines that are reasonable. So they're actually looking for that to a degree and realize that they can't do that in their local market, and in many cases their states are not high enough level to really get those things done. They know that has to be presented to them from a national perspective. So they're not necessarily looking for software, which was obviously a business of the Institute in the past, but they are looking for the guidance to be incorporated into their softwares. And I'm going to cite Canada as an example, where so many of the items that are, Canadian national government regulated are available directly inside the caseware product. And, you know, when you think about what happens with the way we get things done in the U.S. market through CCH and Thompson and so forth, as we try to get those in the audit tools, sometimes those are clumsy at best.
Yeah. We have where that's really showed up, and I'm going to answer your question, respond to your question in a couple ways. Hit the technology side, and plus the whole notion of standards, clarity of standards, more practice aids for standards, that kind of thing. What we've put out that's created, member attention, let me put it that way, has been the risk-based assessment standards, auditing standards, which have gone to a principles-based standard, which are really a lot of the internal control things we all learned back in the day when we took auditing in college. That said, there are new components as well of the risk-based standards, and one is the evaluation of internal control in the IT environment. Now, we have repositioned our IT section, the CITP, to better concentrate on some of the components that were actually part of an old SysTrust, service that's still around. But all of a sudden, the whole notion of the importance, finally, the notion of technology as far as being the guts of the accounting system and the guts of internal control and the whole guts of availability, uptime, security, privacy, and reliability being a big component of our standards. We're seeing growth in our IT area and what we're doing in IT in those areas. We're now repositioning to move to give the greater masses of auditors better IT, assessment guidance. And then now putting those right in tools, great idea, and I'm definitely going to pass that on to our folks that work with Thompson and CCH. But one of the other things we're doing in standards, and trust me, I listed the standards where you sit back in your chair, you watch that WIP, unbilled work in process, build up for any given client, and it's double what you quoted them. You say, oh my gosh, what in the world is that? And you find out that's what it costs you to implement a standard. Couple things going on with relationship to standards to change kind of that lack of guidance thing. Number one, we won't issue a standard without the guidance out there. Sometimes we make it a little difficult to find. I'll definitely grant you that. We could do a little better putting that guidance in the face of our members. Number two, we're moving to slower exposure draft periods so that we can pilot test standards so that they can be scalable, so that they can be realistic, so that they can be applied in a way that's not obscure or a burden to businesses. The ASB also undertook, in response to members and my complaints as well, a project to better simplify standards and get greater standards clarity. we have a ways to go, and moving the needle on standards is creates a lot of angst for our members in implementing a new standard. But I'm pleased to report we have a lot of process, in all these areas, and especially the information technology side of standards. Also, in the area of XBRL, we're putting a lot of our time and energies into XBRL.
So, Jim, it's just the four of us here, Randy and Brent and you and I. You want to talk a little bit about the CITP credential and how that kind of fits in, what the future is for that, how you see that developing?
Well, it's kind of a takeoff of what I've said earlier, Greg. The future is very bright. We're seeing renewed interest in all of our credentials. And what's very, very interesting for me, being, an old IT guy, at the early days of IT in the profession, where we're all kind of looked at as kind of the oddballs over there, in the IT side, and, those guys instead of us guys at times, that what we're seeing today, and in fact that, that IT taint, was no different in some of the other specialty areas, business valuation and forensic, that kind of thing. And what we're seeing today is now all of a sudden a convergence, a coming together. We always kind of saw it there in a bit different ways. It's coming together today, but a convergence of those disciplines into the core of the profession. For example, is what I just spoke about, is all of a sudden where, initially IT was all about, can you do my time and billing, and then went to installing accounting software and doing a lot more in that way, to a place where evaluation of the IT environment, security, privacy, reliability, all those key components, all of a sudden through, the risk-based standards and just a number of complexities out there today, the importance of the information technology skill for an auditor, thus the rise we're seeing in CITP, the interest in the IT section, and we're better positioning our tools and resources in that area. So that is going very well. So we're seeing that convergence all of a sudden, IT, now it's us instead of those folks over there. Business valuation, exact same phenomenon. If you talk to business valuators, they were always kind of off there a little bit, doing something different. Well, if you look at international financial reporting standards, you look where FASB is going, it's all about fair value, in financial reporting and mergers and combinations in every place we look. So all of a sudden, that discipline is now coming to the core of the profession. Thus, the ABV designation is a very, very, very popular. We're seeing the same thing with forensics and litigation support, most notably forensic. We potentially we'll have a forensic credential. And again, the whole notion of fraud and discovery of fraud and prevention of fraud, more than anything, very important to the core of the profession. So it's interesting. I guess if you're in the profession long enough and you work in these specialty areas because you love them, you enjoy them, you see the benefit, eventually you start to see big-time traction taking place. And we're seeing it now in all of our specialty areas, and, it's wonderful to see it in CITP.
So kind of an oddity, though, that I've been thinking about while you've been describing this, Jim, is we actually see a whole lot more demand for, some of the more sophisticated internal controls and IT audits. And honestly, from our K2 organization perspective, we actually have created course this year for CATS and a lot of the other audit pieces to supplement the pieces we created in internal controls 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, Randy. You make a good point. I always tell a story. I'm going to give away my age, anybody listens to this. But I used to audit through the computer. Now, get this. Only a few will remember this. I used a CATS tool called on IBM System 34 called DFU. It's nothing more than a data file utility, but it extracted data, and you can do anything you wanted with it. Then we saw everything come of age, of real tools, and it's amazing how important those are today. I think your CATS, you're right on with that course. The interest for auditors and accountants at large in these areas, the thirst for it. Anybody doing 404 work, again, all around internal control, using data, using the computer to do the work instead of doing the mundane work that gives auditors a big headache. And quite frankly, the audit tools are an attraction to the profession, computerized audit tools and techniques versus some of the old ways of testing and things of that nature.
Yeah,
but Jim, I believe you're right on track here. I mean, that is, the audit function is still our franchise. I mean, mean, that's mm-hmm. that is what we retain as a profession, and the intersection of that that function with technology, I believe, is really, really important. We're going to spend more time in future editions of Tech to Go talking about some of the technology based RBA, the risk-based assessment tools that are starting to roll out now. There's actually starting to get to be some pretty interesting stuff coming out, yeah. And as you've said, lots of firms looking around saying, you know, the idea of the auditors going to get a technology guy to come in and bless their audit that's a short-lived vision. These guys are going to have to do exactly what you were doing 35 years ago and start auditing through the computer instead of the answer for many of them right now is, well, we'll just expand substantive testing. There's a limit to how far you can expand that, right?
Yeah, there's another point too here. Again, it's everything that's old is new again, Greg.
Uh-huh.
And Randy got me going on this, and that is the whole notion of continuous auditing. You know, that was the talked about thing for many years. We at the AICPA had publications on it. But if you look at, the ability to store large amounts of data today, you look at the commonality of databases, you look at common objects, everything out there, the ability to plant what, we used to call embedded audit modules, on a machine and, take by exception and shoot you an email with an agent or whatever when there's an internal control violation being made, no matter where you are, changes the whole notion of auditing into that continuous environment. And so I think, because everything that's old is new again. I just want to make one last point, and I don't mean to dominate here, that the CIT, I have to say this, Greg, forgive me for this, but I have to say our CITP direction, it's very, very pleasing to see the recent upsurge and the better focusing. And I got to give, as much as I hate to do this, Greg, give you credit. I don't hate doing this at all. I'm just kidding you. We're a long-time friendship. But it's leading our CITP credential committee and really getting us on track and really doing a great job, and all on a volunteer basis. And just let me use this opportunity to thank you for that. And
tell you what
a difference you've made for us. And thanks for making me look good. All I can do is tell a story. So
thanks very much for the kind words. But as you well know, that there's a full staff and a full committee that actually makes all that stuff happen. But it is exciting to see people figuring out now that when an auditor goes in and says, I'm going to look at internal control, and if I'm smart enough, if I have the tools, if I can go to a Brent Goodfellow and have Brent explain to me how a group policy user access control function over on the technology side can help me implement my internal controls on the auditing side and help me determine my risk, I'll there be risk-based assessment. That's what the CITP is all about.
Yeah.
And that would be a fun kind of an engagement, wouldn't it, Brent?
It absolutely would, no question about it.
Well, let me know when that first happens, will you?
It's already happened.
Yeah, that's true. It is. Well, Jim, I thank you very, very much for sharing with us today and spending some time. Invite you to hang around, and we're gonna talk about some other things here and move on from PCPS and the Institute. But I do wanna thank you so much for spending some time and thanks for all you do for the profession in your new job over there at the Institute. I hope you plan just on to keep working until you fall over, right?
That's exactly true, and I know that we should put some money on the table, just to see who keeps working the longest here, right? Because we love it so much.
I can't tell the difference between work and play anyway. So, well, listen, let's move on again here. I wanna take a second here to go over to the Crass Commercial side, I want to thank my friends out in New Jersey, the guys at ADP, for paying our bandwidth bills and sponsoring Tech2Go. You know, they've done a pretty darn good job over the years in the payroll world. You probably heard about them; they've been in all the papers. Done a great job there, and over the last 3 or 4 years, I do have to hand it to them. They have come a huge distance in figuring out how to work really closely and partner really well with CPA firms out there. So and public accounting firms, all sorts of practitioners, tax and accounting practitioners are looking at that payroll world, going, you know, I can have that sticky kind of a transaction, that sticky kind of an engagement with my client, and not have to do all the heavy lifting. I can go out and partner with the guys at ADP, and there are other people that do it. There are not very many that do it as well as ADP, and I would, if you're thinking about payroll, I would encourage you to give them a call and take a look. And if you're not thinking about payroll, just between you and I, it's something that I think you ought to be looking at. And I think I can prove to you now empirically that some firms are making a lot of money doing payroll and have very, very happy clients as a result of it. So that would be my advice. Give them a call out at ADP and tell them that the guys on Tech2Go were talking about them, and you decided to visit with them a little bit on how you might want to handle payroll. So a segue from that to scanners. I don't have a segue from that to scanners, but I do want to talk about scanners. So this is a question that's come up a lot. People write in or call or grab you at a show, and they say, I just have a very simple question. What scanner should I buy? And Randy, when they ask you that question, what do you say to them?
Well, I actually have a short, simple answer. And Greg, as you know, we'll have a web link following the podcast available so people can actually see the product recommendations. There's really two basic classes of scanners. There's what we would call production quality scanners that can be anywhere from work group to full-scale scanners to what we would call personal scanners. And there's a couple of vendors that I particularly like in their product offerings, one of those being Fujitsu and the second one being Canon. And I think those two vendors serve as good measuring blocks. The annual AIM conference is going to be here in Boston the first week of March, so there might be a little bit of change of position in this. But fundamentally, I use Fujitsu as my measuring block. I believe that their work group scanners are really a good choice for a lot of CPA firms, whether we're dealing with the 5510 or 20 at the low end, up through the 5750 kind of in the mid-range, on up to the 5900 family on the high end. For personal scanning and for field scanning, the ScanSnap line is one that we would traditionally suggest, particularly with the new introduction of the small S300 being kind of an ultra-portable version of that, or the traditional S500 510 class family of the ScanSnaps. Probably the biggest issue to remember for production purposes is getting those pages processed properly, because one of the key repetitive issues that we see in CPA firms is that the scans have not been cleaned up or compressed with a cleanup software like a Kofax VRS. And it can make a big difference in terms of page size and usability.
Now, Randy, do I need to go out and buy a product, or do a lot of these scanners ship with either the VRS product or the Abisoft has a product that is built into a lot of them? Is that good enough, or do I buy something on top of it?
No, actually, the one that ships with the scanners, Kofax VRS Basic is the one that typically ships with those, is actually sufficient. The Professional actually has more capability, and that is actually quite well explained on the Kofax site in a little subpage. And the Abby product has been getting good good traction because I follow actually multiple different associations discussion groups, and Abby has come up multiple times, and it's a product that I also recommend. The bottom line, though, is the one that comes with it probably is good enough for a lot of firms, particularly the smaller firms, 10 or less. I think you'll find that's really sufficient for the type of documentation being handled by those groups.
So, Randy, how many dollars is a firm thinking about? Give me an approximate budget for this for a production level scanner. And I know that's a little bit like how much does it cost to build a house, but
yeah, it's a little more precise even than that, though, Greg. Because as it turns out, the lower end production scanners, which have retails in the $1,200 or $1,900 range, depending on whether you're doing a flatbed or not, the less expensive product is without a flatbed, and we usually recommend that the first scanner of the organization has flatbed capabilities. Even with those retail prices, we're routinely seeing the street price be about $700. Now, I like to pick on that $700 street price for the production quality scanner because it'll do 25 pages a minute and includes Kofax VRS. And if we contrast that to a ScanSnap, which is typically going to be $350 to $425, somewhere in that range, you're still going to have to add the compression software if you don't have it available. So at least one time you're going to have a $300 or more expense for this cleanup software.
Right.
But, you know, those production scanners at 25 pages a minute do a pretty nice job. It's a little overstated. My old rule of thumb was that whatever speed you want for a scanner, put a couple of zeros behind it, and that's the price. Nowadays, you can pretty much divide by two, and that's still a pretty accurate statement. So if you want a 25-page-a-minute scanner, $1,250 is not an unreasonable expectation. If you want a 57-page-a-minute scanner, you're probably going to spend somewhere around the $3,000 ballpark. So and that's a pretty good rule of thumb. If you're a small firm of 10 or less, you're probably going to be okay on a 25 to 35-page-a-minute scanner. If you're a larger firm that maybe has 35 to 40, you'll be much better served with a 35, 45, 55-page-a-minute scanner, somewhere in that range. Spend the extra money there. We don't want to waste practitioners' time waiting in a line or, for that matter, even admins waiting in a line to get to that scanner.
Sure. So, Randy, on the ScanSnap, and I don't mean to be critical of it, mine's sitting 6 inches away from my computer right here, and I wouldn't have a desk without my ScanSnap on it. But the problem, if you can call it a problem, the problem with the ScanSnap is that it's not a TWIN compliant product. And you know, as I'm looking more at some of these new products that are web-based products that reach out through your USB and want to control your scanner. Mm-hmm. I was looking at a product from Bank of America, a direct deposit function where I could scan a check and have it deposited to my account, remote deposit for individuals.
Yeah, the BankServe Deposit Now.
Yeah.
Approach. Yeah, yep. It's a kind wonderful. Of,
yeah,
approach.
But for the individual,
yes.
they want to reach through and control the scanner. Can't control that ScanSnap.
Yes, and as you might recall, and this is really for the listeners broadly, the way scanners actually make their interfaces into the operating system happens in three different styles, one being TWAIN, the one you named. TWAIN is an acronym that stands for Technology Without an Interesting Name. Developed by HP, Apple, Microsoft together to get these USB scanners to interface. The software that you chooses to interface to one of these middleware pieces like TWAIN. And the software products very specifically will have requirements for TWAIN or its bigger brother known as ISIS, which stands for Industry Standard Interface Specification, a much greater control, much higher speed interface, or there'll be proprietary interfaces. So I think the vendors are actually going to have to create more and more products that support TWAIN and ISIS, those two standards, And that should be a trend that you'll see across many of the hardware manufacturers. So we agree one of the objections to the ScanSnap is the lack of Twain interface. And typically, in a production quality scanner, you're going to have the option of either Twain or ISIS, and you'll have better paper handling capabilities too.
Sure. So have you heard anything about the guys over at Fujitsu adding Twain to the ScanSnap line?
Should I say yes or
okay.
Should I say no?
Okay. Okay. Well,
you know,
on to
I
hate to put people in situations like that.
Yeah. Bottom line, though, Greg, is that it's under review, and we'll find out how that unfolds
right.
over the year. But as it turns out, that type of interface can actually be implemented in several different ways. So just expect that there could be a solution along that line.
So let me throw out another question to my friend Brent Goodfellow. Brent, what do you say to the guy who calls, the practitioner calls and says, "Well, I've got this multifunction machine here, this copier fax scanner. How come I can't use that?"
Well, you mean because it's not Twain compliant?
Well, because it's, or do you tell them that's an okay thing to use? What's your experience?
My experience is that a lot of these multifunction devices, these large multifunction devices, are just fine as a network scanner. But obviously, if they support the Twain standard that Randy was talking about, or the ISIS standard, then that makes things a whole lot easier. If they don't, then you're using proprietary type software, which is similar to what Fujitsu does with the ScanSnap, to get the images, converted to a format that you can use. And so you have to look at each situation a little bit differently. But in a lot of cases, those big devices are very functional and useful.
Okay, Randy, you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that is
okay.
a good position.
Okay, good. Now this little ScanSnap 300, this little portable, Brent, do you have one of those in your bag to go out with yet, or have you avoided buying that yet?
I have avoided it.
Boy, have you seen it?
I have. I
okay.
have. I'm just not sure how much I mean, I don't do a lot of auditing, obviously,
right.
So a lot of the work that I do, we connect to web-based applications, and we enter our notes and things that way and don't necessarily have to scan documents. So it's
right.
just the type of work that we both do, you know.
Sure, sure. Well, I looked at it, and I wanted one just because it was cool, even though I couldn't figure out exactly what I was going to do with it, because like you, I'm certainly a long ways away from an audit team. In fact, if I tried to get too close to an audit team, they would run screaming down the hallway, I'm sure. But it is a really sweet little piece of hardware. Randy, you've actually tested it, right?
I have, and I think it's a very nice step forward. The size reduction is notable and significant. There have been other competitors that have tried to produce similar size products that don't work well, and this is really quite acceptable in its current iteration.
So just a last couple of words here on best practices, Randy. You've taught an awful lot of firms, a lot of practitioners about the move to a digital office, and it all starts with becoming, getting stuff digitized and in digital form rather than in paper form. A lot of conversation around what's the best practice here. Is there a single answer? Are there two answers depending on firm size or on service mix? Just give me the high level on that.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm answering the right question. You're saying, if I was going after a scanner, is there a size of the firm that really drives it, or a particular type of work that we're doing?
Well, what I'm looking at is what I was trying to ask about is what your suggestion would be in terms of best practices. There's there are many firms out there that say, you know, I'm gonna put a personal scanner at everybody's desk and let them all do low volume scanning there. And there's another idea that says I'm gonna have all of our scanning centralized. And I don't know if either of those answers are correct.
Or if the
answer is in between. Is there a quote best practice?
I'm tracking with your question now, and you're absolutely right. I've seen firms go both ways, and I think the best practice approach is more centralized or regionalized scanning, not necessarily wanting a scan person, if you will, but the quality, cost, speed of individual scanners at individual desks compared to the ability to put things through in volume in work group scanners. Over and over again, I'm led to the work group scanner solution. I would rather have multiple work group scanners in most cases. Now, one could argue, well, that means I'm forcing a practitioner to get up and leave their work area. And you know, there are situations, depending on style, where, you know, dropping in a single piece of paper, it makes sense to pull it in through a small local scanner. But by and large, if you consider that the paper that you're going to work with, if it can be scanned before you touch it, the sooner we can truncate the paper, the better off we are. And in general, administrative types can truncate that paper faster and better than a practitioner and cheaper. So that's the general strategy, but you're right. It does depend on the firms. Now, when we talk about something like 1040 work paper organization, trying to get more and more firms to moving to scanning in advance, if you will, and using one of the many software products that helps organize the 1040 work paper, that's one example of a truncation. You know, for audit jobs, in many cases, we try to get everything we can electronic, but if the client insists on providing us paper, would prefer to have an audit admin get that paper scanned so it can be dropped in the appropriate engagement product and so forth. So again, centralized scanning generally seems to be more effective, less cost.
Well, thanks Randy and Brent for your thoughts on the scanner thing. That's always a conversation we're going to be having for a long time. We're still not even halfway through getting firms off of paper and into the digital world. So we're going to be talking about this for a long, long time. I want to switch gears and jump over to our another topic that we touched on just a little bit a couple of months ago, and we've had a couple of people ask us to spend a little bit more time talking about it, and that's the area of financial analysis software. And after I kind of set this up, I'm going to ask Jim Metzler what his opinion is on where firms are in this world. This whole idea of adding value to delivered financial statements. I mean, we as a profession prepare financial statements, and then we sit down and hand them to our clients and maybe visit with them a little bit, and out the door they go. And there is tremendous value to be offered to our client in actually preparing what I would call an analytical report based on what's in that financial statement. And several of the vendors have come up with products that seem to do that reasonably well. All of them a little bit different flavor. We've got the ProfitSense product from SageWorks, web-based product that kind of takes numbers, and it's a black box, put numbers in one side to get words out of the other side. It does a pretty darn nice report. Thompson's got their financial analysis CS product. CCH has their profit driver product. There's BizBench has a product, a whole list of them, and we review these things in the magazine. But what I want to ask you, Jim Metzler, is the information that I have as I poll firms, and I look at how many users each of these different products have, and how many firms, and I know how many firms are out there, and I know how many people buy these products, and we're at like maybe 15% of the firms. So 85% of the firms are not availing themselves of this whole idea of adding value in presenting their client with a financial analysis report, something that that their client can go home and look at and say, "Gee, I now make sense out of my financial statements." I became a real believer in this when I was visiting a firm in Indianapolis, Jim, and the partner there handed me a postcard, and it showed a man sitting at a desk visiting with a client across the desk, and they were exchanging a document or a report, and the caption said, "You've already got your financial statements. Now let us provide you analysis." And he, you know, this partner said, "What do you think of this?" And I looked at it and said, "Wow, what a great way to impress your client, to show him, you know, what kind of value you're adding." And he said, "Well, except the problem is we didn't send it out. One of the local banks sent it out, saying to their customer, you got your report from your accountant. Now bring it into us and we'll explain it to you." What's your thoughts on that?
Well, the thoughts are, and, you know, like you, Greg, I've been a big proponent of that when I was in practice. There was even, like, you know, I don't mean to bring up AICPA products, but an older AICPA product called Performance Views that was kind of similar. And I know a lot of the, back in the day, early, some of the trial balance software, of course, came up with certain key performance indicators. The problem, we have two problems in the profession that... And none of them are good. There's no good reason for them. One is that we have the seasonality, and people do practitioners prepare the financial statements, and oftentimes they just put them in the mail and mail them to the client without sitting and going over the numbers. And when you do sit down and go over the numbers, many practitioners are perplexed as to how to start. They don't know how to really start the conversation, because it's hard for them to say that, you know, office expense is this much over last year. But just a few trends, and I've told practitioners when I was coaching firms, you know, pick top five measures, no more than five measures, view it as a scorecard, and study those five measures that are appropriate for that client. And those are the only things to go over, you know, with the financial statements really on the side. It opens up, the wonderful side is it opens up a conversation that leads to, you know, again, the whole trusted advisor relationship over those key performance indicators. You know, trends over 5 years, just five items, really critically important. The problem we have, you know, in the profession is, one, the seasonality, we get too busy, we're so relieved. We got the financial statement out and the tax return in time for the bank or for the IRS, and we are not proactive in initiating those kinds of conversations with our clients. We have started an initiative at the Institute, you know, PCPS, called Small Firm Advantage, to help small firms be able to understand their value in those and then articulate it in a way that they don't have to be rocket scientists, but to ask probing questions around those measures. It's an opportunity that we're all, you know, we, you know, put us all out there, you know, leaving on the table. And given trying to get so much work done in a small period of time, many practitioners don't take the time to use those indicators and go over them at the same time the statements, and don't follow up when things get a little lighter. So I think that the message to practitioners, I guess my job is to continually convey the value they add and view it and, you know, highlight some of those tools.
one of the
less
problems.
Is more. I found in that you get too much. Less is more in those analysis areas.
I agree, Jim. One of the problems that I believe that practitioners have is they look at 30 or 40 financial statements a week, and they're very, very good at looking at a financial statement and immediately, almost viscerally, seeing the changes. And
yeah.
not really being able to sit back and go, you know what, my client does this once a year or once a quarter, and he's a salesman or he's a scientist or he's an engineer or something, and he doesn't have that same understanding. So when I look at it and say, gee, your quick ratio is really falling, and I can see that and understand it immediately. And if I'm talking to a bunch of accountants, they'd all look at me. If I'd say that, they'd all look at me and say, well, duh. But your client looks at that comment when you explain it to him, and he looks at you and thinks, you're the smartest guy in America because you've just explained something to him.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how you add value.
Brent, do you able to get your partners to do this regularly or as much as they should?
Well, not really my area, but I can tell you that our firm is part of the BKR association, and
right.
they have an agreement with ProfitSense, and I know that as a firm we've used that particular product on a number of occasions. I don't think it's across the board. I don't think it's part of every engagement, but I know we've used the tool once or twice that I'm aware of. And I think the general feeling is that it adds value. There's no question about it. But a lot of clients just seem to not care. You know, they don't need all the graphs and the numbers. They want you to tell them, what they need to do to make their business more profitable. For the most part, some like all of the backup as well. So
sure.
It just depends on the client.
Good point. The interesting thing to me is why this ends up being a technology discussion, and guilty as charged because I made it a technology discussion here. But many times I see people come to to one of the K2 technology updates to get information about this, and really, while it's a technology solution, it's really not a, at least I don't think it's a technology decision. This is something that a managing partner should look at, I think, as a best practice. Does that fit, Randy?
It does, and in fact, kind of along the same way as Brent was, one of the tools we do like to recommend is the ProfitSense SageWorks product. And comparable, because we think that adds value. But we try in this particular case to kind of get the attendees transitioned away from a technology type of approach to a real practical business approach. Like Brent said, I think what a lot of the clients want to hear is the summary of what's going on. And I think the tools that are out there help generate the information that we can talk to the clients with. And I know it's hard for accountants to picture this, but a whole lot of the world doesn't think in numbers. And where we're so comfortable and want to talk numbers, a lot of the clients hardly can identify with something even as simple as an inventory turn or et cetera. And trying to get that where we can help them make their business more profitable and use these tools to help the clients be more profitable, now we're in a much more valuable position because we've turned away from a compliance piece, which most people don't want to have to do. They do it because they have to a true value add that, I'm happy to see my accountant if they're going to show me how to work less hours and make more money. But I'm not real happy when I'm having to do tax returns and audit work and other things on that side of the world.
Yep, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. Well, we're getting to the point where we have to start paying attention to the clock here, and we do have we always save our our 2008 server discussion, our topic of the month, to the very end, and we try and make Brent do this in just a couple of minutes. We should probably put it at the beginning and spend more time talking about it. But we certainly do have some time, and we want to make sure that we go through that. As you'll recall, the 2008 Microsoft server product is just about ready. It's been RTM'd and it's just about ready to go out the door. Brent can give us an update on that, but it's such a big area and so many different things in there that we decided to kind of carve this out and have a recurring slot for the server topic of the month. So with that background, Brent, what is the 2008 server topic of the month this month?
Well, how about security?
Oh, good. We can cover that in 6 or 7 minutes.
That seems to be on everybody's mind. Just a quick update. The official launch is, since this is the February podcast, the official launch is February the 28th. It's going to be in Los Angeles, although there are going to be a number of, as you might expect, virtual launch events. And they've invited a number of Microsoft-certified trainers to participate in those live meeting, virtual launch rooms, if you will. And I'm happy to report that I'm going to be one of the presenters on February 28th. So I won't be in Los Angeles, but I will be part of the virtual launch event, which is kind of exciting for me anyway.
Good for you.
As far as security goes, I think it's just important to note that we've really kind of gone full circle with Microsoft operating systems over the years. You'll remember in the early days of Windows 95 and Windows NT on the server side, you would create server shares and that kind of thing, and by default, everything was wide open. And the reason that was to reduce the complexity of sharing the resources on those machines with other users to enhance the networking experience. But obviously the world in which we live has changed pretty significantly, and security is now on top of everyone's mind. Consequently, Windows Server 2008, which will be launching this month, and Windows Vista, and they share a common code base. Vista's been out for about a year, in fact. Service Pack 1 for Vista will release at the same time that Windows Server 2008 will. The philosophy, if you will, about security is now shields up, and everything is locked down initially. And then instead of just doing a file share, for example, you actually have to open all of the various holes, if you will, for individuals to use the resources of the server. Now, that can be a daunting task for non-technical and technical people as well. And so I wanted to just highlight this tool in Windows Server 2008 called Server Manager. Microsoft says this is new on the server side, and technically I guess it is, but for anyone that's seen Small Business Server, they have seen Server Manager before. This is something that's been around for a while. The nice thing about Server Manager is it's a management interface that allows a network administrator to add a role, what's called a role, to a server, and this is something new in 2008. So, for example, a role might be DNS or DHCP, a name server or a server that hands out IP addresses. For the network administrator, this server manager actually walks in a wizard format, walks you through configuring that role on a particular server. And it's much more user-friendly, if you will, than trying to do that by hand without the use of the wizard and trying to make everything work so that the functionality that you're looking for is actually there. So that's the short topic of the month, security. And Windows Server 2008 is much more secure than any previous operating system from Microsoft.
Well, that's it's good to know that once Server 2008 gets out there, we'll have all of our security problems solved. Randy, won't that be wonderful?
It would be superb. but not expected.
I just recorded Accounting Firm Security to Go this morning with Dave Cieslak, and I jokingly asked him if we were going to have enough content to do this for the rest of the year, and he assures me that we'll be able to fill up that hour a month just fine. He's not at all concerned. So,
well, it might be interesting to note that Service Pack 1 for Windows Vista actually contains somewhere north of 500 security fixes. So, you know, it's certainly not a perfect world, and every time you plug one hole, it's like the gopher game. You know, you knock one down and two more pop up somewhere else.
Yep.
Whack-a-mole has always been a problem with this environment. And I thought it was actually pretty fascinating, Brent, you probably already knew this too, that the Microsoft basically is going to release Windows 2008 with Service Pack 1. So on release, they're going to say they have Service Pack 1 available.
Yeah, and that's because of that shared code base. So,
yep.
You know, when Service Pack 2 happens, and maybe that's another year for Vista, it's also going to be Service Pack 2 for Windows Server 2008.
Yeah.
Finally making it easier for people like me to keep track of what's going on. Well, guys, we've done it again. We're up to our hour. Again, I wanna thank Randy, both you, Randy, and Brent, for your continuing support and participation at Tech2Go. It's interesting. We've now been doing this for well over a year, and it's fun to see the number of people that are joining us. And I thank you a lot for your help and your participation, because as I've told you before, all I do is go out and find smart people and hang out with them, and then people somehow think that I had something to do with all the smart stuff you guys do. So thanks very much. And Jim Metzler, a huge thank you to you for spending the time with us. We really, really appreciate it. And I want you to know
sure.
you have an open mic whenever you feel like you'd like to join us here on
great.
On Tech2Go or any of our other podcasts. Just send me a note and we'll schedule you in, and you're certainly an integral part of what's happening to and with small practitioners across the country, and we'll be happy to offer you whatever bully pulpit we can.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks so very much. Our next recording, again, is March 13th at 3 p.m., a following recording March 20th at 12:30 p.m., both times Eastern Standard Time. A final, again, thank you to our friends at ADP for making Tech2Go possible. We appreciate your support, buddies out there at ADP. Thank you so much. This concludes episode 14. Jim, Randy, Brent, thanks very much.
That wraps up this edition of Tech2Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust. This has been a podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.